Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. It's your programme about money, work and the economy. I'm Sam Fenwick. Coming up today, NATO Summit 2024, strengthening defence, supporting Ukraine and welcoming new allies. We'll hear from their newest recruit, Sweden. Also today, India's Prime Minister is visiting Russia.
I would hope that we have stable price of fertilizer. I'm glad that this conversation is happening and I hope that we are able to get, you know, stable prices of fertilizers for the industry.
We'll hear from the farmers who want to see their prices falling on essentials like fertilizer. And find out how China's biggest electric car company, BYD, is trying to get round EU trade tariffs. That's all to come here on World Business Report. Let's get started then. The US President Joe Biden is welcoming the heads of NATO member states to Washington today for its annual summit. Among the key topics on the agenda are affirming support for Ukraine and strengthening deterrence and defence. It comes as a day of mourning is being observed in Ukraine after one of the worst waves of Russian missile strikes in months. At least 41 people were killed and 166 injured. The main children's hospital in the capital, Kyiv, was among buildings hit. Speaking at the Pentagon in Washington, the head of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, denounced these latest attacks on Ukraine.
In Ukraine, Russia continues its brutal war. Only today, we have seen horrendous missile attacks against the Ukrainian cities, killing innocent civilians, including children. I condemn these heinous attacks. At the summit, we'll make decisions to further strengthen our support to Ukraine, and Russia must understand that they're not able to wait those out. They need to sit down and accept a solution where Ukraine prevails as a sovereign, independent nation.
NATO was established 75 years ago with 12 countries from Europe and North America. Since then, 20 more have joined at various times. The growth of NATO has significant implications for Russia and its war in Ukraine. While each member country allocates its own defence spending, NATO encourages them to spend at least 2% of their GDP on defence, but this is a guideline and not a strict requirement. Sweden is the latest to join. They're spending 2.4%. Earlier, I spoke to Paul Johnson. He's their defence minister and he's just arrived in Washington. I asked him what signal the growth of the alliance sends to Russia's president.
NATO is larger now than it's ever been before, and because we are 23 allies who are coming to Washington investing 2% or above into our defence investments, especially significant, I think, with Sweden and Finland. In this case of Sweden, we're giving up 200 years of military non-alignment, but that is, of course, due to a realization inside Sweden that NATO supports its partners. And if you want to have access to Article 5 and NATO's common defense planning, you need to become a full-fledged member. We also have assets and capabilities that will consolidate the whole northern flank inside the alliance due to our experience on operating on the Baltic Sea and our Arctic capabilities, our defense industrial base, and also our Russia expertise.
Yet it appears that Russian missiles are still getting through Ukraine's defenses.
We will, of course, take note of that as well. I think there has been measures taken to strengthen the Ukrainian air defense system. Sweden has provided the Hawk, Iris-T, RBS-70, and also provided the Ukrainians with AMRAMs. But more things need to be done, both to support the Ukrainians with air defense systems and artillery shells. And since the Ukrainians right now are also mobilizing up to 14 new army brigades, it's very important that they have armoured vehicles as well.
Is there enough money in the pot to be able to arm Ukraine the way that they need or the way that they would like? I know that you're spending 2.4% of your GDP on defence, but other countries aren't, are they?
Well, as I said, 23 at least are doing it now compared to when defense investment pledge was announced 10 years ago, then it was three allies. So I think the trajectory is good. Then Those allies who hasn't reached 2% by now, they have plans on how to reach it. But what we do find is that 2%, of course, is a floor, but it's not the ceiling. And we are challenged both with replenishing our stocks, since we sent a lot of defense equipment to Ukraine. And we also need to build up stronger armed forces all across the alliance right now, because we take note that Russia is willing to take great political and military risks as well. So that's necessary to continue the defense investment above the 2% as well.
As we said, there are some countries that aren't meeting the 2% yet. So countries like Croatia or Portugal, Italy, Canada. Do you see your role now as a new member to try and encourage those countries to commit to 2%? And how might you do that?
We have a trajectory up to 2.6 by 2028, and I noticed several of the other countries also are going to be significantly above 2% for a long time. And I think you have to look about this as, in order to maintain cohesion and resolve within the alliance, it's of course important that all allies try to meet the 2% targets as quick as possible, due to the fact that we're exposed to the most severe security environment in Europe, to my mind, since the end of the Second World War, because we have a full-scale war on the European continent again. So there is a sense of urgency in investing into our armed forces.
It is difficult for countries, though. I mean, you must be able to tell us about Sweden. You know, we're in an inflationary period. Prices are a lot higher. Governments are struggling with their fiscal responsibilities.
Of course, that forces us all to do tough priorities. But I mean, a few decades ago, many of the allies were significantly about 2% and 3% during the Cold War. And I think you have to look at this as an investment also into our own security. And you have to grasp how significantly the security environment has changed due to Russia's full-scale invasion into Ukraine and the kind of risks that creates. This is being done, of course, on the doorstep of NATO territory. And the best way, of course, to assure peace within the Euro-Atlantic area is peace through strength. And that means that we need to invest into our armed forces.
In February, Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, talked about the potential of withdrawing US support for NATO under a second Trump administration. How worrying is that?
Well, I think that it's crucial to keep the unity within NATO, and that NATO is strong. And I think that's an American interest and it's a European interest. And we appreciated the U.S. leadership since both the war broke out, because the U.S. has increased its military presence in the region. And at the same time, of course, also taking a great responsibility for supporting Ukraine. With all of that said, I think that we Europeans also get it for real. And that's also been helped by President Trump in that regard, that we need to be 2% or even more, because it's unsustainable that one ally stands for almost 70% of defense investments and the other 31 stands for 30%. So Europe stepping up and rising to the occasion, both when it comes to defense investments and supporting Ukraine, I think is really crucial.
And
disregarding who win the elections in November. Sorry.
And perhaps more important now than ever, that those countries that have pledged 2% meet it quickly, as you've said.
Absolutely. And I think there is a sense of urgency. And just during this last year, I mean, Sweden increased its defense investment with 27% in 1 year. And I see many other allies who are doing the same as well. So I think most of us who come here to Washington, it feels good that we're in 2% or more. And 2% is a floor, but not the ceiling.
Looking round the table of NATO leaders, you've got President Macron of France, who is looking in a weakened position. You've got President Joe Biden, who is looking in a weakened position. You've also got Germany also looking in a weakened political position. Is the political volatility across NATO members one of NATO's biggest weaknesses at the moment?
Elections, they come and go, and it's something that NATO been exposed to for many, many decades. And I think what we should focus on right now is not the elections or muddle into any kind of domestic elections, but focusing on what we can affect, and that is keeping NATO strong. And therefore, we should be laser focused right now on making sure that NATO's new defense plans are executable and NATO has the ability to deter and defend. So I think that will be the focus discussed also on the NATO summit right now, and of course developing Ukraine's relations with NATO as well.
But if you were Vladimir Putin and you were looking at that table, you might think these individuals are weak. I'll just keep going.
Well, I think what Vladimir Putin got wrong from the start of this war was two things. He underestimated the Ukrainians' will to fight, and he underestimated the unity within the Euro-Atlantic community. And EU and NATO has never collaborated as closely as we have done in the run-up and during the war in Ukraine. And we've been able to provide the Ukrainians with $90 billion of military equipment. And I think there is a resource. And of course, Ukraine now is closer than ever for EU and NATO membership, and defense investment is going up, and NATO has two more allies, who makes us safer and NATO stronger. So I think Vladimir Putin's perspectives are not necessarily all that favorable.
Sweden's defense minister there, Paul Johnson. Well, meanwhile, India's prime minister, Narendra Modi, is visiting Russia to, as he puts it, deepen ties between the two countries. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has criticized the call, calling it a huge disappointment and a devastating blow to peace efforts. Yesterday, the Indian and Russian presidents met for informal talks over tea. Today, discussions have become a bit more formal. One of the high priority issues on the agenda is the cost of fertilizer. India has become increasingly reliant on Russian supplies. In the first half of the 2022-23 fiscal year, Russian exporters captured more than a fifth of India's fertilizer market, surpassing China as India's largest supplier of fertilizer. These significant imports are partly due to discounts offered by Russia. However, in September, Russian suppliers stopped discounting and began to sell at market prices. And this move put pressure on Indian companies' ability to stock up and led to an increase in government subsidies. Rudra Chatterjee is the managing director of Luxmi Tea Company. It produces 30 million kilos of tea every year. And he explains why fertilizer is so important to its production.
Fertilizer is very important in the tea industry. It contributes to a significant part of the yield and one of the most important inputs that the farmer can use. The tea bush lasts for more than 50 years. So the way to regenerate the soil and ensure that the tea yields are good is using fertilizer, including urea and MOP and phosphate and zinc. Those are very important ingredients for growing tea.
What have prices been like for you, for fertilizer for you over the past couple of years?
Important fertilizers like diammonium phosphate, which used to be 24,000 to 28,000 rupees per ton in 2015, has increased to 30,000. So that's from 24,000 to 30,000. That's moderate increase. The potash prices have gone up from around 17,000 rupees per ton to 25,000 rupees per ton. So that's quite a significant increase. Some of the fertilizer prices where we depend on imports have increased because of the tightening markets. You know, the imported fertilizers, A, stopped being discounted, and also because of World Trade Organization rules, Indian government stopped subsidizing those fertilizers. So the cost to farmers have increased in terms of fertilizers.
And what about buying from Russia? So they were discounting, weren't they, for a time, some of the Russian suppliers, but then they stopped discounting. How did that affect
you? That is right. That increased the prices. So we had to pay higher prices for fertilizers. And that affects farmers quite a bit because a sudden jump in fertilizers and associated with that, you know, climate change and dropping crops, that becomes producing tea much more expensive.
Narendra Modi is meeting with Vladimir Putin. One of the discussions up for conversation will be the price of fertilizer. What do you hope might come out of those conversations in terms of the price that you will buy at?
Well, I would hope that we have stable price of fertilizer, and I hope that we are able to import fertilizers because it's a very important thing for Indian agriculture, especially the tea estates depend on stable price of fertilizer. And I'm glad that this conversation is happening, and I hope that we are able to get, you know, stable prices of fertilizers for the tea industry.
Does it worry you or does it bother you that you are buying Russian fertilizers? The president of Ukraine has said that the meeting between Mr. Modi and Mr. Putin is a big disappointment to him and that it possibly a big blow for peace efforts as well.
I think You know, having low food prices and having farmers who can pay their way for agriculture is very important to India, and it's very important to the world. You know, when it comes to farm and agriculture, typically the most important thing is to keep stable prices. And already, because of various reasons, climate change and because of trade challenges and freight costs, agriculture prices are increasing. And it affects the Indian poor, it affects the Indian farmer. So it's very important for India that we get low and stable prices of fertilizers.
That was Rudra Chatterjee. He's the MD of Lakshmi Tea Company, one of India's largest tea producers. You are listening to World Business Report on the BBC World Service with me, Sam Fenwick.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt, to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Now, China's biggest electric car maker and Tesla's biggest rival, BYD, has reached a deal to build a billion-dollar manufacturing plant in Turkey. Now, this comes days after new tariffs on Chinese electric vehicle imports were imposed by the European Union. Turkey is part of the EU's customs union, which means that vehicles made in the country and exported to the bloc can avoid the additional tariffs. Marketa Gregorovova is a member of the European Parliament for Czechia, and she is also a member of the Group of Greens and sits on the Parliamentary Committee on Industrial Trade. I asked her if building this factory in Turkey means that BYD could avoid some of those latest EU tariffs.
It probably will avoid at least part of the tariffs. And, well, to one side, you would say that this is quite a logical step. But the same way that currently Hungary sort of became a political gate for foreign interference, so to say, and malign influence, I wouldn't like to see Turkey becoming an economic gateway for cheap goods manufactured by child and slave labor in China with dumping prices which our companies cannot compete with.
You're making some assumptions about BYD's use of labor. What evidence do you have that they use child labor?
Well, because they are a Chinese company and
but you can't
China's
just assume that because they're Chinese that they are using children to make their cars.
Well, I'm not saying they are directly doing that. Chinese companies are completely under the rule of Chinese Communist Party, and they are being, as per evidence that was presented also in the European Parliament, where I was hearing this evidence, they are being used in labor, mostly manual labor. So I'm not saying BYD is exactly, but BYD is the biggest company manufacturing vehicles in China. I would be very surprised if they did not use any of this.
But these 150,000 cars will be made in Turkey.
Parts of this, yeah, of course, but you also need to mine certain parts. You need to mine lithium and other components, and that would be happening absolutely in China. There's not that much lithium in Turkey, truly.
So what can you do then? Can you try and stop Turkey from doing this? I mean, they're part of the customs union, but they're not part of the bigger, wider EU.
Yes, well, of course, you can reapply some of the tariffs again to Turkey. That would be probably the simplest solution. But our relationship of Turkey and the EU is quite complex. There are many aspects where we could deepen the relationship, definitely in the terms of the trade. So there could be some sort of deals if you don't let through the Chinese dumping price vehicles. We could make agreements on other sides.
BYD made last year, 2023, 3 million cars. BYD is saying they're going to make 150,000 cars a year out of this plant in Turkey. That's about 5% of their annual manufacturing, if you take those figures from 2023. It's not very many, is it?
You know, the electric vehicle industry is still just starting to bloom. Give or take, both the European Union and China are actually having some sort of plans. Of course, in the EU, it's called the Green Deal, but China is also trying to lower its CO2 emissions quite heftily because they are the biggest producer in the world of them, and they know they have to do something. They also cannot just subsidize completely one industry and let everything else go. But we could see that once these sort of measures, once everything is more electrified, Green Deal and everything is more in place, I don't know, let's say in 7 to 10 years, I could see these numbers skyrocket.
That was Member of the European Parliament, Markéta Gregorová. She was speaking to us there. We asked BYD to comment on the allegations she made. We're still waiting to hear from them. Well, investors have been sitting up straight and listening to every word said by Jerome Powell today as he's being grilled by lawmakers. Here he is setting out his priorities.
The Federal Reserve remains squarely focused on our dual mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the benefit of the American people. The committee has stated that we do not expect it will be appropriate to reduce the target range for the federal funds rate until we have gained greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably toward 2%.
Jerome Powell, who I understand is still speaking, Fiona Sincotta, market analyst at Citi Index, is joining us to mull over what Mr. Powell has been saying. He's saying that we're heading towards that 2% target. He has been saying that for quite some time, hasn't he?
It does feel like it, doesn't it? You know, that's right. They're just looking for more evidence to really feel confident that inflation is going to cool to 2%. I mean, we've had the PCE reading a few weeks ago. That's the Federal Reserve's preferred measure for inflation, and it cooled to 2.6%. We've got another inflation reading this Thursday, which is expected to show that inflation cooled to 3.1%. So it's definitely moving in the right direction. We've also had data recently last week from the US, which showed also a sort of slight weakening now in the labour market. Also in the services sector, there's been some weakening. So there are some signs that, you know, that price pressures could start easing and that, you know, the Federal Reserve is on track. And the market's actually pricing in a 75% probability now of a rate cut in September.
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Now, inflation, he said, I heard him say, is not the only cause of concern. He talked about policy restraint, didn't he? Just tell us about that. What does he mean by that?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, that's something to keep in mind, especially I think as we're heading towards the US elections as well. Obviously, we're talking about the Federal Reserve takes a long-term look at what's happening in the US economy. So they're going to be looking at elections, potential ideas of who might be spending what as they sort of make their pledges towards the in their campaigns for the election. So that's
one
something else that they're going
to
be watching.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
One we will all be watching. Fiona Sincotta from Citi Index, thank you very much for joining us. We're just coming to the end of the programme now. And we're going to look at rockets because Europe's new heavy lift rocket, Ariane 6, is due to launch from French Guiana later on today. It's an important vehicle for both European companies and governments who want to put various bits of tech into space, but its launch comes amid something of a new space race in which Elon Musk is one of the key figures. Kate Underhill is with us now. She's from the European Space Agency. She's a propulsion engineer, works in Paris. So tell us, Kate, this is a significant launch for the European Space Agency because there are so many different agencies and different private companies putting stuff into space already, aren't there?
Yes. Hi. Good. It's great to talk to you this afternoon. I mean, in Europe, we have up until now been very focused on getting this European Space Agency launches. We've had Ariane 5 previously, 1, 2, 3, 4. Before that, we had the Vega launcher as well. And now we have Ariane 6. Like you said, it's our new heavy lift launcher. It's the one that can get institutional, governmental, military, science payloads into orbit and get that data to be used for the benefit of European citizens. But there is now it's coming more and more like the space economy. Space is becoming part of everyday economy, everyday lives. And there is a big increase in the number of satellites expected to be launched and a big increase in the number of players in the market, including commercial players in Europe who want to set, launch up their own rockets.
So it is really important then for the European Space Agency to be among that. This launch needs to be successful.
It's very important for Europe to have this autonomous access to space and at this kind of size of rocket. So a lot of the commercial players are coming on the market with a much smaller rocket. It's normal rockets are quite hard to make. But we have with the experience of the previous European Space Agency rockets, we have what we call a payload capacity of something like 20 tons into low Earth orbit. So that is a resupply mission to the International Space Station, and over 10 tons to geostationary orbit, which is where all the telecommunications satellites are being launched. So we can launch two telecommunications satellites at the same time on this one rocket.
So is that about, you talked about the volumes there, is that about how much you can send up into space or the size of the kit that you can send up into space?
It's both. It's both mass and also volume. Exactly. It's what we call the fairing, is something that protects a satellite as we're going up through the atmosphere. And that also defines how wide and how big the things are. And satellites previously have been getting lighter but larger, so we have to fit them under the fairing. Or we've been getting lots of very small satellites, but trying to launch 30 or 40 of them at the same time.
And how, so you're a propulsion engineer. So in the simplest terms as possible, how hard is it to get that kind of heavier stuff up into the orbit?
Yes, it's obviously it's not very easy. And this is one of the big differences of Ariane 6 compared to the previous launcher, Ariane 5, is the upper stage engine. It's a cryogenic engine using liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, and it's reignitable, which was not the case before. And that is very useful because we can change orbits. So this is where we can, again, launch lots of different satellites in lots of different orbits and be very precise in where we put those satellites. So the engine, we ignite it once, place a certain number of satellites, and then ignite it, go to somewhere else, put a number of other satellites. Then each satellite is in its perfect orbit and can operate straight away.
I think the launch is in about 2 hours, so you'll be watching it with your biting your fingers with possibly behind a cushion.
It's so from launch, we have a launch window from 7 o'clock to 11 o'clock this evening, so a very large launch window.
British
summertime. And you can watch it live on ESA Web TV from 6:30 this evening.
Thank you very much, Kate Underhill. And you can also follow that story and the launch online at bbc.com/news. Thank you to all of our guests today for talking to us here on World Business Report. Don't forget, you can always get a podcast of the programme. You can subscribe to it wherever you get your BBC podcast. See, Greenfield was the producer of today's World Business Report. Vivian Nunes will be with you here for the late edition of the programme. Thank you very much for listening today. I'm Sam Fenwick.
We're in the El Gharbia region in Egypt to uncover the hidden side of a trade that feeds one of the richest, most exclusive industries in the world.
The documentary from the BBC World Service brings you award-winning journalism, unheard voices, amazing culture, and global issues.
We try to look at the bigger picture.
Search for The Documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.